Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food. For thousands of years, humans have been preserving food by way of fermentation. It's the metabolic process performed by yeast and bacteria, and it creates the flavors we love in beer, cheese, and pickles. But lately, a full-blown fermentation craze has been taking root among chefs and home cooks alike. Why now? One answer to that question is Rene Redzepi.
Quickly, we peered into fermentation as sort of the main pillar of what makes the Noma flavor.
Redzepi, of course, is chef and co-owner of Noma in Copenhagen. Noma's been named the world's best restaurant not once, not twice, but four times. It has a dedicated fermentation lab, and every single dish that leaves the kitchen includes something fermented. Noma's trade secrets are now being revealed. Redzepi recently teamed up on a new book with David Zilber, the mastermind of Noma's fermentation lab.
It stemmed from both my and Renee's frustration with a lot of fermentation books out there that will show you 101 recipes for sauerkraut.
The book is called The Noma Guide to Fermentation. I have no doubt it will be the fermentation Bible for years to come. Renee and David recently spoke about the project with Good Food contributor Jillian Ferguson.
Evan and I were talking about the book, and we were joking that this is actually the first Noma book that people are actually going to be able to cook from. Was that part of the intention?
You know, it's funny you say that because we were joking about the very same thing.
Yeah.
That this is our third book, and the first one where people are cooking. I mean, already now on Instagram, you can find people cooking from it.
Yeah.
What does fermentation do for you as a chef at Noma?
It's like the best way to explain it shortly and briefly is when you have a sushi and you have soy sauce on it, it's like something happens. It makes it better. It makes the difference, actually. If you know how to work with these ingredients and know how to produce them, you will have an array of ingredients that will make cooking better and actually also make you cook easier. And so to us at the restaurant, we have hundreds of things ranging from, you know, fermented grasshoppers to the simplest berries and so on. And each of them we consider like Legos. So we have a basket full of Legos. And before fermentation, we had like two handfuls. This is simply giving us so much more power to build with and to add complexity. We wouldn't be Noma without it.
Yeah, this is your mise en place now, right?
This is our mise en place. This is a separate part of the kitchen. We, you know, years ago, we decided to take the process of fermentation and separate it from the daily chore of prepping and make it its own entity. So we invested into a space and we found a team that were solely dedicated to the pursuit of newness in fermentation.
Yeah, which is extraordinary. So, David, that is your domain, right? The fermentation lab. And
indeed it is.
I imagine people listening think, what is a fermentation lab?
What is a fermentation lab?
So maybe just describe it for us and tell us what goes on there.
Yeah, I mean, a fermentation lab can just be a kitchen where you just have space set aside and time set aside to be able to do this stuff. I had the honor of designing the new laboratory in Noma's new home. We moved a couple of kilometers down the street onto this amazing property on a lake with a hectare of land. The new lab is basically, you know, a room with a work counter. It kind of looks like a very functional kitchen, minus some gadgets that you would probably expect to see perhaps in a hospital. But outside of that space, outside of that little research and production space, off in the wings of the lab, we have about 10 different rooms, and each one has its own smell. Each one has its own characteristic. They're all temperature and humidity controlled. And in each one, you basically find a separate chapter of this book. And so we divide the ferments in physical space, just like we've divided up the ideas in the book, because it's all about crafting environments. Mm-hmm. As a fermenter, that's all you're doing. You are a shepherd who wants his sheep to stay healthy and happy, and you can't get inside the minds of your sheep. You have to coax them. You have to guide them. And as a fermenter in the lab, that's what we do. We just make environments to make food delicious with the help of some microbes.
So before we get to how people can do that at home, I do want to talk about how you do that at the restaurant. For instance, this summer you had a completely vegetable tasting menu, which I know is a huge challenge. And I can imagine that fermentation made that possible for you guys to create a 20-course tasting menu with vegetables in a way that if you hadn't had that pantry, you might not have been able to.
I mean, we probably would have been able to, but I don't think people would have been super happy. No, that was when we decided to move to the new space, our new Noma space. We've been open 15 years and, you know, we just moved in the past year. One of the things that we wanted to do was to separate the year into its natural seasons. So in the plant, in the growing season, we are a vegetarian restaurant. And many years ago, when we decided to make this move and started building and building on the ideas, we were worried. How are we going to make a vegetarian meal taste as delicious to our guests as, you know, cooked fish, cooked meats? And that truly was the moment in which we said, okay, we need to build on this fermentation idea. And that's when we decided to separate it from the kitchen into its own, we call it the lab, but it is also a tiny kitchen, of course. And, you know, you can actually grow things, make things, if you have time and space, that will make a bowl of spinach as good as the cooked steak.
Because you can actually create garums, for instance, out of meat and then add them to seasoned vegetables, right?
You can do that, but you can also make it out of, there's one that I think is amazing. It's made from yeast. There's another one that's amazing, the egg white. They taste like they're made with meat. I mean, it tastes like meat stocks, just with more complexity to it.
So what is a garum, just so we are clear?
All right, so let's go back in time 2,500 years to northern Africa, where the Phoenician port city of Carthage was a booming metropolis. And they developed the technology to, I mean, they were fishermen. They would bring all those fish into port, but then they would turn that fish into an amazing sauce that had the ability to last. Fish would be chopped up, salted, and left to basically stew in the Mediterranean sun for months. From there, all the liquids would bubble out, and that flesh would break down into amino acids, causing this flight of aromas. And it just is depth of flavor. That's what you describe it as. And yes, there's a bit of funk to it, but it's not funk in the sense of spoiled fish or rotten fish. There are only certain microbes at work because, again, you're crafting an environment. Now, in my time at the lab, we've expanded on that and made it from everything from yeast to chicken wings, grasshoppers, insects, the larvae of fruit flies. There really is no limit to where you can take this, and it is just a magic potion.
Okay, so taking it to the home cook, I was thinking we should probably start with the first chapter, which is lactofermentation, because that's all you need to lactoferment vegetables, fruit, is salt and a mason jar, right?
Just a quick preface about what lactofermentation is for the uninitiated. If you've ever had sauerkraut with your frankfurter or kimchi over rice, these are processes of lactofermentation. These are hardy vegetables that were then soured as microbes consume whatever sugars might sit in those plants and then transform them into lactic acid, which is the flavor of like a sour cucumber pickle. It's an amazing process and it helps to preserve these foods. And this is how this stuff has been done for thousands of years. Fermentation was the first act of preservation. Now, along with that, you actually transform flavors and make them quite delicious. And that's what has probably got humanity to keep doing this stuff. Now, as an entry-level recipe, I would say that fermenting in brine and making your own sour pickles yourself is one of the funnest, most easy, accessible things you could do. Like you said, all you need is a vegetable. You can do it with fruit as well. But in the book, we have white asparagus. If it's not white asparagus season, you can use green asparagus. We've done it with carrots, you know, farmed baby carrots, radishes. So it really is more about the principles than the ingredients themselves. But as a quick walkthrough, you pack your vegetables, your stocky vegetables, into a jar, pour some water over it, pour out that water, measure the contents of both the vegetables and the water, and then do a little bit of math calculating, let's say, in between 3 and 5% salt. Dissolve that into the water, pour it back over top of your vegetables, seal it up tight, make sure everything's sitting underneath the water line, and then you wait. In about 2 weeks, you'll have a completely transformed asparagus, carrot, radish, thumbelina, beet, whatever you want. And from there...
We're in L.A., so it's probably kale.
Don't do it with kale. It's not as good as you think. And from there, I mean, we use pickles. We're a pickly restaurant.
Yeah.
You know, especially in the winter months.
Yeah.
We use them to season broths made of shellfish. We use them to bring acidity to our main courses, just slivers of them.
And you can use all that juice too, right?
Yeah, that's the best part. Brines can then be used to season your next meal.
I love to bathe seafood in them.
Oh, yeah? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so a freshly shucked oyster, if you just quickly bathe that in one of those brines, it tightens up the seafood and gives freshness. Instead of, you know, a lemon,
mm-hmm.
it adds more to it, I think.
Definitely.
Later on in the book, the more ambitious projects are related to more mm-hmm. Japanese techniques, shoyu, miso, mm-hmm. koji. If someone is an ambitious home cook and they want to, you know, take on a weekend project, maybe go to the hardware store before they start this, what would you suggest that they tackle first from the book?
Make koji first, and then the rest will follow. Koji is a fungus that originated as a crop fungus, a blight on rice fields in Southeast Asia. And bit by bit, it was domesticated like dogs from wolves, to serve humanity instead of harm it. And it has this remarkable transformative power. It takes starches and makes them the sweetest sugar. But then beyond that, the mold itself has this amazing bloom of flavors. It's passion fruit, it's honeysuckle, it's apricots. You open the chamber in which you ferment it. And like I said, you have to craft an environment. So you have to make this little steam box, this little tiny sauna for your koji, and recreate the tropics of southern China. And when you lift that lid, just the waft of fruit is like stepping into an orchard of your own making. If you make that, if you master it, and it's not impossible. I've done it in some pretty tricky situations during the pop-ups in Australia and Mexico when Noma's traveled. Once you master that, you'll see it for what it is, and you'll understand why it's so special. And from there, the rest is easy. To make miso after you've made koji is no more than not even half an afternoon's work. To make shoyu, again, put in the work at the start, and then the patience will pay off the rest.
And to me, once you have that, then for me, it's definitely the chicken wing garum.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
Well, you take a lot of chicken wings, and you roast them until they're completely golden and crispy, and then you grind them up, and then you'll add salt, and you add your koji,
mm-hmm.
and then you let time do its thing, and it transforms from... you know, ground up roasted chicken wings into this liquid. It's just an incredible ingredient for you to have on your kitchen shelf. And I feel confident that people would use it on everything, because imagine like a very, very, very meaty, umami-rich Tabasco-style thing that you can just drizzle onto everything and it gives that kick of flavor.
Okay, my last question, David, is really about the cover of the book, which is gorgeous.
An amazing illustrator as well, Paula Troxler, did all the illustrations for the book, and she has a wild imagination, so I thank her for that.
So tell me what I'm looking at.
You are looking at a hand being grown over with the mycelium of a fungus, but it means a lot more than that. A mycelium is the roots of a fungus. If you actually see mold or penicillin growing on your stale bread, you're looking at mycelium. But the meaning of it all stems from a concept in Korean cuisine, the one of sonmat, or hand taste. And that's the idea that an individual fermenter, a cook, carries with them particularities that are unique to them and them alone, that a grandma up on the mountain will make her jiangs different from a grandma down in the city. They might both be good, but they'll be unique. Now you kind of put that idea of hand taste through the lens of science, and you realize that there is this thing called microbial terroir. And that's the idea that, yes, on your skin, in your gut, in the room, in the air, wherever you are, whether it's Japan or South Africa or Boston, Massachusetts, every unique location will have its own population of microbes that maybe you can't see, but you will be able to taste if you ferment. Hand taste is absent in factory-made food, in highly processed, uniform, checkboxed factory products that you can buy in grocery stores, and it is absolutely present in foods you make yourself. It is the idea of the handcrafted, and it's the idea that every time you go to ferment, you're leaving your own personal thumbprint, your own handprint on the foods you make and consume. And to me, that's a beautiful idea.
Amazing. Well, the book is extraordinary. It is history. It is recipes. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
That was Noma chef and co-owner Rene Redzepi and David Silber, director of Noma's Fermentation Lab. They recently spoke with Good Food contributor Jillian Ferguson about their book, The Noma Guide to Fermentation. Later in the show, we'll be revisiting my conversation with Rene's wife, Nadine Redzepi, so stick around. After the break, one of my favorite fermented foods. I'm talking about cheese. We're headed to Somerset, England, the birthplace of cheddar.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. From mac and cheese to hard-shell tacos, cheddar is incredibly ubiquitous in American food culture. But unfortunately, we can't take credit for the orange cheese. It was actually born in England. Good Food contributor Simran Sethi recently visited the cradle of cheddar to learn about the history and the people behind this dairy staple.
Although it's taken a backseat to mozzarella, last year America produced 3.7 billion pounds of cheddar. From microwavable mac to goldfish crackers, cheddar cheese has been incarnated time and again in the modern grocery store aisle. Gordon Edgar, an author and cheesemonger in San Francisco for more than a quarter century, says most of that cheese is made in large industrial factories.
The milk gets pumped in, people press buttons, you know, and, you know, the whole process happens in a closed vat, which means unlike traditional cheesemaking where, you know, you're hand stirring the curds or you're cheddaring the cheese yourself, all this stuff happens in a closed vat with no human input.
Traditionally, cheddar and other cheeses were made by hand. But as cheddar gets even more industrialized, that human connection is disappearing.
Then it kind of plops out the other end in a 640-pound block, which then, you know, gets cut down to other sizes or not, depending on its use. The biggest factory that makes cheddar makes about 1 million pounds a day.
But what are those masses of cheddar made of? The Food and Drug Administration has a pretty broad definition. Basically, the minimum milk fat content needs to be 50% of the weight of the solids, and the moisture content needs to be 39% by weight.
So however you get your cheese to that level, you can pretty much call it cheddar.
The industrialization of cheddar has deep roots in our history, Gordon writes in his most recent book, Cheddar, A Journey to the Heart of America's Most Iconic Cheese. The story of cheddar, he explains, is the story of modern Western society.
It's been something that's been about survival of communities.
So the story of cheese, we could say, is the story of us.
You take this protein, which is milk, which is very perishable, and you take it and you're converting it to something that can last a lot longer so that you have food, you know, 1 month down the road or maybe 1 year down the road, or you can trade it to other people and bring something else in that your community needs.
In the United States, Gordon says, cheddar mirrored the industrialization of our food supply in the 1850s and quickly became the most popular cheese in the United States.
Understanding how it's gone from a farm-made, woman-produced food to being a highly technical, industrialized, untouched by human hands food really tells us a lot about where our food supply has changed over the last 150-some years.
But the story of this iconic cheese stretches back to the 11th century in and around the village of Cheddar, nestled in the district of Somerset in southwest England. In its most traditional incarnation, cheddar is in the ranks with a handcrafted chèvre or brie, a far cry from those 100-pound factory blocks that Gordon describes. And it's that history and provenance that inspired Anna Jewell to start specialty food tours to the region. She's a former cheese purveyor who wants to give cheese lovers an intimate look at the cultures, history, and places behind the world's most renowned cheeses.
For most people all over the world, cheddar is the most common cheese that people experience and know. And yet really the cheddars that are produced today are not necessarily, most of them, the same type of cheeses that were typically known of cheddar in the past.
And she wants to introduce visitors to that past with the story of the dairy farmers and makers of great cheeses.
It's all connected. You can't just talk about food without really knowing and getting to know these people and being able to share what they do with us.
Anna's tour, called Cheddar Odyssey, starts at the iconic cheese shop Neal's Yard Dairy in London. But it wraps up in Cheddar's birthplace, which is where I sat down for an unprecedented gathering of the only three cheesemakers making cheddar as it was originally produced in the place where it originated.
I'd like each of you to tell me how you would describe cheddar cheese. We'll start with you, Tom.
Oh, brilliant.
Meet George Keane and James Keane of Keane's Cheddar, Jamie Montgomery of Montgomery Cheddar, and Tom Calver of Westcombe Dairy. Four men who cross generational divides and not only have deep connections to the land and what it brings forth, but to each other.
There's so much variation in what people call a cheddar that it is hard to get back to what we think cheddar is. And yeah, so we think cheddar should come from the cheddar region in Somerset and that it should have the depth of flavour that Tom was talking about.
The last person you just heard from was James Keane, the cheesemaker at Keane's, a family business that started making cheddar in the late 1800s. The family milks its own herd of Frisian cows that graze in local pastures. And that grass is the reason that Somerset became the ideal place for cheese. Because where you find grass, you'll find cows. And where you find cows, Jamie Montgomery says, you find a lot of milk.
There was that much milk being produced that they had to do something with it because they didn't have the population to drink it. And so nearly every farm would have had to have said, right, okay, we've got to make cheese.
The traditional cheddar Jamie Montgomery just described was made on the farm, not in a factory, and brought out the diverse flavors of the naturally occurring bacteria in Somerset milk. George Keane, James's father, explains.
The basis is not pasteurizing the milk. We're taking the milk straight from the cow and producing a product without damaging the milk. The cheese speaks for itself. A raw milk cheese has more character, more breadth of flavor.
How did it get off the farm? It was women's work, and that certainly changed.
The change from everybody making cheese on the farm to fewer, bigger dairies was really forced onto the industry by the Second World War. In order to ration cheese, they didn't want it made on the farms, and so they built factories into the areas where there was plenty of milk and said, right, we're going to collect all your milk, turn it into something which we can then cut into tiny little pieces and ration. And so all the cheddar making was shut down for the period of rationing, which is quite a long time.
Up until the war, there were an estimated 400 cheesemakers in Somerset. But years of government rationing almost erased that handcrafted tradition. When rationing stopped in the 1950s, there wasn't a lot of financial incentive to go back.
But by then, the Milk Marketing Board was guaranteeing the collection of all milk. And so you didn't have to make cheese because you could just sell the milk. And so it was only the sort of people who either really enjoyed it or saw it as part of their vocation. Always making cheese is one thing, but returning to making cheese after a break, I think that's much more significant.
What Jamie just described is so significant that Slow Food, a nonprofit dedicated to preserving food traditions, established an artisanal Somerset cheese presidium, which helps safeguard traditional foods and production methods that, in the face of industrialization, are in danger of disappearing.
You are the only three, currently, the only three raw milk cheddar cheese producers in the birthplace of cheddar.
Mm.
Why aren't there more?
Well, it's quite difficult to do.
we don't want anybody to think it's really easy, do we?
Which raises the question,
why are you doing this? You could just I don't know, grow maize
or... Oh, don't worry. There are,
prepare
there,
cars.
There are plenty of days. There are plenty of days where we ask that absolutely same question.
One of the reasons why we what keeps us going is about the people and the relationships that we've actually built.
Oh, God, yes.
There's three of us here sat on a sofa. We are, you know, competitors, essentially, but also incredibly close friends as well. And I think that that's actually incredibly unique. And I don't know any other industry like it.
Of course, things were even tougher during the war, Jamie says. His family has been farming in South Somerset for generations, and making world-renowned cheese for over 70 years.
Rationing meant proper hunger. And you have to remember that when we diss how bad the cheese was. It didn't matter. It really didn't matter. Because all of the focus was on efficiency.
George and James Keane, Jamie Montgomery, and Tom Calver's passions for reviving lost flavors is part of the reason why Anna Jewell's cheddar trips are growing in interest.
We don't think of British food culture as being something we're drawn to. And yet that was a result of a priority they had to be able to feed the masses. And now we live in a time period where there is this restoration of artisanal foods in Britain, and the people that are involved with that, it's remarkable.
Anna says this renaissance has also helped American artisanal cheesemakers learn from centuries of handcrafted production. And Gordon Edgar adds, keeping those traditions alive is critical.
It's something that really connects the people to the heritage and to the land. And I mean, I do think that there's no cheddar exactly like some of the cheddars that are still produced in the traditional region of cheddar.
But as artisan production has reemerged and raw milk cheeses with diverse cultures have become more expansive, consumers now have a wide range of flavors to choose from. As a veteran cheesemonger for the Rainbow Grocery in San Francisco, Gordon suggests cheese lovers be adventurous.
If you've eaten one cheddar your whole life, or you always get that one block, you know, at the grocery store, try a different one and see if you like it. The whole world of traditional cheddar, where if you see something, a cheddar with a natural rind and all that, it's a very different tasting cheese. It's much more complex, and, you know, it might not be the perfect thing to put in your quesadilla or your mac and cheese or whatever, but it might be a great thing that you really like eating when you're just eating a piece of cheese. And most Americans probably never tried that.
By expanding your palate, you're getting a chance to taste not only diverse flavors, but the stories and history behind them. I asked the same question about the importance of producing cheddar in the place where it originated to the makers in Somerset. Here's George Keane.
It's my home. It's what I was brought up with. It's the best thing you can do with milk. So it's a business, it's a lifestyle. It's always interesting and you're always learning. It's great fun.
Can anyone else top that? No?
I think there's a hunger and a thirst for people to scratch the surface a little bit harder and understand what they're actually consuming. And I think that that's a really fantastic thing.
That's Tom Calver. His family has been selling milk and cheese in Somerset for nearly 150 years.
The more you focus on the flavour and the more you focus on the quality of the flavour, everything else starts to slot together.
For these three cheesemakers, the flavour of the end product starts with sustainable and diverse farming practices. And those grazing cows, raw milk, and hand cheddaring have also helped evolve the American palate.
Giving those little bit extra flavours. And we're trusting the American audience that have been buying our cheese for a while to be ready to make that step with us.
For Good Food, I'm Simran Sethi.
This piece was made possible by the Independent Producer Project. You can see photos of all the Somerset makers on the Good Food blog, along with an excerpt of Gordon Edgar's book about cheddar. Visit blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. And you can learn more about Slow Food Artisanal Somerset Cheddar Presidium by visiting slowfood.com. Coming up, fermented beverages. I'm talking with wild food expert Pascal Bodar. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
I'm trying to find the true flavor of the environment, and I'm trying to translate that through my ferments.
When it comes to fermented drinks, Pascal Bodar is your man. After all, he was raised in Belgium, the land of beer. Armed with his expert knowledge of foraging in LA's terroir, he's able to brew some extraordinary elixirs. He's even written a book about how to do it yourself, called The Wildcrafting Brewer. Hello, my dear.
Bonjour.
Am I right in thinking that this book is a bit more accessible than your previous book?
Yeah, the first one, you had to know a little bit or at least be interested in foraging. This one, I think anybody could do it. You probably can read the book. You could even go to the local store and start creating with it. And if you love foraging, then you can have a lot of fun.
And when you say the word brewing, for a lot of us, we hear the word brew and we immediately think of beer. This idea of what you're presenting here, it goes beyond, quote, beer in the way we think of it.
Yes, if you think about it, the appellation beer or wine are really clearly defined. A lot of the things I do are pretty much brewing with what nature has to offer. So it doesn't always fit that specific definition of a beer, a wine. It's like going back in time and do what people used to do in the old days is to actually brew or make alcoholic beverage with the environment.
How much of beginning brewing is trial and error?
It is so easy. I mean, if you go back to the original brewing method, is you're basically making a sugar tea. First, you boil it to extract the flavor, and then you stick some yeast in it. You basically ferment it for a specific amount of time, and then you bottle it, and you're done. This was the way some of those quote-unquote primitive brews were made.
Okay, so you have a lot of stuff here.
Yeah, I do always bring stuff.
A lot of, I'm sure, very delicious stuff. So pick something and explain to us what it is and what you've done, what you're playing with.
Well, this one is a typical beer that I do locally. I call that my forest beer. And this one contains some of the plant that you can find in Europe too, by the way. So it's not just Southern California. It's a plant that's made with a beer that is made with mugwort, which is very bitter but highly aromatic. It's also a culinary plant, mostly used in Asia. But this plant was used by the Celt and Viking as instead of hops. Hops is rather new, actually. The first mention was the year 900. So before that, people still made beer or similar beverage, you know. So this one is pretty much mugwort. I put a little bit of yarrow. I have a little bit of willow bark, a little bit of willow bark, which was used also for medicinal brew in the Middle Age. So it's bitter.
It's what aspirin comes from.
Yes, that's right. I think I probably put a little bit of turkey tail mushroom.
So basically, you've made a tea.
Yeah, so you basically just, it's that simple. You basically make a tea. You boil it maybe for like 30 minutes. If you use hops, you boil it longer. You need a little bit longer time. But that one, like 30 minutes, cool it off, strain it, add the yeast, and voila.
Did you add sugar, or is there enough natural sugar in all of these herbs?
No, we can go into the book there, because that's what the book is talking about. What kind of sugar can you use?
Because often you're not using white sugar.
No, I actually don't use white sugar. I will use white sugar for maybe wines, for example. It's a bit too neutral, but for beer, you can use molasses, you can use brown sugar if you wanted to. You can use grain, of course, like any regular brewer. But I like to experiment too. You know, I'm from Belgium. We do those crazy beers over there. So I like also to use fruit molasses, you know, because finding sugar in nature is not... It's actually quite interesting. You don't have a lot, really, even in Southern California or even Belgium. You got honey, but molasses is a good way to do it.
So when you say fruit molasses, I immediately think of something like pomegranate molasses.
For example, but locally I will do it, for example, with cactus pears.
So you forage cactus pears.
And then you boil it until you basically pretty much end up with just sugar and flavored sugar. And then you can use that to start a brew. You know, I don't know if I can call it a beer at that point. You know, I'm very loose with the definition, by the way. If it tastes like a beer, I call it a beer. If it tastes like a cider, I call it a cider. If it tastes like a wine, I call it a wine type of thing.
So these sugars and the lack of grain in your recipes,
yeah.
Is it because you're trying to go back to the basic and do everything from foraged? It's like you don't want to be given anything.
It's my passion. I try... you know, through the beer or through the brews that I'm making, because we're making much more than beer. The book is about sodas and wine and meads. I'm trying to find the true flavor of the environment. And I'm trying to translate that through my ferments, through my beers, the sodas. Some mead will taste like the mountains. Some beer will taste like the chaparral because they contain a bit of sage. So it's an exploration of local flavor through beverage, really.
Okay, let's taste this.
So that one is still, it's only like 3 weeks old, but nice.
So does it ever happen that it doesn't do that? That it doesn't create anything, that level anything, of fermentation?
Anything can happen with my beers.
Where does
sometimes
the
yeast... Sometimes too much.
while I'm drinking this, tell me where the yeast came from for this.
California juniper berries.
The flavors are different, yet not so strange that you can't understand what it is.
You will recognize that as a beer, but...
Indeed.
And at the same time, you're going to go like, yes, but it's not the same. This is probably what you answer, you know, you're talking like 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. Those are probably the flavors.
And this is probably very similar to when we hear that quite a long time ago, people would drink these kind of fermented concoctions rather than water because it was safer.
Yeah, it was safer. They didn't always understand the process of pasteurization, but they just knew that boiling or making a beer was safe to drink. So then all the Nordic countries were pretty much into beer. And if you were going toward the south of France and Italy, they used wine. They didn't need any water. They would just crush the grapes and make wine.
So let's go back to the juniper berries for yeast.
Yeah.
So juniper berries, I think of, you know, we all think of gin when we think of juniper berries. But when you look at the juniper berries, particularly ones that you've collected, you see that there's this dust on the outside of them.
Right. So there is a white coating. And the white coating is pretty much composed of wax and wild yeast. So it's easy for anybody to really start playing with wild yeast. You just need to go to the store, get some organic grapes, and you can see there is this wax on it. So you basically just have to stick that in sugar water in a jar, shake it 3 times a day. So you basically put like maybe 20% sugar, 80% water, bunch of grapes. You don't even have to break them. You shake it, and after 3 days, you're pretty much guaranteed to have a fermentation going. And you can use that as your starter. You can do that with so many different fruits. You can do that with flowers. You can do that with different barks. And every yeast will be a little bit different, too. You're going to have to learn that. For example, elderberry yeast, we go way up. You're talking like 12%. Why? I have no idea.
So you're talking about the alcohol percent.
The alcohol content, yeah. And California juniper berry yeast, we go to 5 or 6%, which is perfect for beer.
How do you manage to make a non-alcoholic soda if it has sugar? You just omit the yeast.
It's just a question of time. Yeah, I can make a soda in like 48 hours. So you're basically fermenting it for 24 hours. You bottle it. So you do the same thing. You extract the flavor. Sometimes you don't even boil things. Let's say I make a wild currant soda. So I take some juice, maybe a little bit of sugar, put some wild yeast in it, stick into a bottle for 24 hours. The pressure will build inside, and then I stick it in the fridge. You're done. You got a currant soda. It's that easy.
Pascal Baudard works as a wild food researcher, brewer, and instructor in traditional food preservation techniques. His workshops and foraging excursions are legendary. His latest book is The Wildcrafting Brewer. If you're not ready to forage for your own food, the Santa Monica Farmers Market might be the next best thing. Let's see what's fresh with Laura Avery.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. So excited to be standing here with Ari Tamor. He is chef owner of Little Prince Restaurant on Main Street in Santa Monica. And of course, Ari, you're probably best known for your Alma days, the Alma era. And now you're back at the market. You've got Little Prince. Apparently, you say it opened about 6 months ago.
Yeah, we started as a brunch-only pop-up in February, and we did 2 months of weekends only and opened full-time in May.
Okay, and it's called Little Prince. It's based on that wonderful book. Why that name?
That book, my mom used to read it to me before bed when I was a kid. So I'd always wanted to name a restaurant after her without being like so logical about it. So when we were thinking about names for the restaurant, we were thinking about like breakfast in bed, something that kind of connotates like lazy mornings. And that was the first thing that popped into my mind. So it's kind of an homage to the book and the whimsy of it, but also to my mom.
That's so cool. All right, so you are here shopping. We love having you here. You're going to be doing sort of an earthy fall dish. Tell us what you're shopping for.
So at Little Prince and kind of my whole career, vegetables, even on a meat dish, are always the star. We treat them with the same care. We source them with the same level of intensity. And we cook them with the same level of thought and just meticulousness. So for this dish, it's actually a dry-aged steak dish. But for me, we're doing all different kinds of brassicas, which is like turnips, Romanesco, cauliflower, or broccoli, broccolini, and cabbage. And we roast them all in the wood oven, glazed in a little bit of aged beef fat, super slowly while the oven's just starting at the beginning of the day. And they get this like very meaty, very earthy, very savory, and also bringing out a lot of their sweet qualities in it to complement the beef.
When you coat them lightly, are you also kind of cutting them in uniform sizes?
We actually roast almost all of our vegetables whole and just kind of watch as we're cooking them. And if one's smaller and finishes early, we'll take it out. But I really feel like cooking vegetables the same way we try to cook meat in as large pieces, like primals, as possible. It allows like the natural structures to change. It kind of reduces the starch coming out of it. And it also, the texture kind of changes. It's like this uniform outside-in cooking.
Okay, and you're sourcing all these ingredients. Who are you getting them from, and what do you look for, say, for example, in a turnip?
So we get our turnips from Florabella. We get the baby Tokyo turnips. And for me, Don and James, they have the best mustardy vegetables. I think like their mustard greens or turnips are really stellar, not just because of the earthy flavor, but because there's so much sweetness that comes out of them. I think that's a part of them kind of picking them at the right time. They're not too small. They're not too big. They bring them straight to market, so the greens are super bright and vibrant. And it's just this kind of fresh, sweet, earthy with a little hint of spice flavor that is difficult to find.
Mm-hmm. And then how are you putting these all together on that plate with the steak?
So the turnips will probably, like the golf ball size, will cut in half or into quarters. The Romanesco will shave down once it's cooked into little crown spears. The broccolini will just take the bottoms off and leave whole. And then the cabbage will pull the leaves back off of. And then everything gets charred back in the wood oven when it's at about 700 or 800 degrees. And they take on a lot. We use almond wood, so we have like a very high heat, very neutral wood. So it picks up some nice smoke flavor, but just a lot of like the charred caramelized flavor from the vegetables.
Okay, and are they rebasted with that wonderful aged beef fat?
Yeah, they'll get rebasted with a little aged beef fat, and they'll get hit with a little lemon juice. And then the last component of the dish is a guajillo, hibiscus, and hazelnut chili jam.
Okay, well, it just sounds delicious and savory, and everything sounds like it's just going to go together beautifully. So thank you for creating that menu, and thanks for being back in Santa Monica.
Thank you so much. It's always an honor to be here and to do this with you guys. I love it.
That was Ari Tamor. He is chef owner of Little Prince on Main Street. Obviously, farmers market driven, love for food and love for cooking, and giving back to the neighborhood. So we're very excited. And I love the fact that it's named after the book. We're talking now with Dawn Birch, who is the farmer who grows those turnips that Ari was talking about, the Tokyo turnip. And we're standing here at Dawn's table. And Dawn, you grow four kinds of turnips. And one of the turnips looks like a radish. So can you help us describe for us what varieties you grow and why?
Sure. We grow many different varieties. We grow the scarlet turnip, which is absolutely gorgeous. It is just the bright pink color. And
all the way through?
No, it's white inside. Mm-hmm. The other ones we grow is the Niseko, also known as the Tokyo turnip. It's a little white turnip, and they're not quite as spicy. They're a little bit of sweetness to them. Our latest one is the Hinona Kabu, and we're growing that by request for Travis Lett at Mountain. And then we grow the standard purple top turnip, which is probably your spiciest turnip. I would say the scarlets are in the middle. The Tokyo Nasikos are the mildest.
Okay, and then why grow so many turnips? Are they good for the soil? Are they just good for you? You just like them?
We have a great market for them. The restaurants love them. It's the first sign that fall is coming. The greens are fabulous. You can just simply saute them, and that's part of your meal as well. You get your greens and your roots, and they're one of my favorite fall vegetables.
How do you cook yours?
We cut ours, cover them in olive oil, and roast them. As long as they're cooked, cook them like a potato, and when you can stick a fork in them, they're ready.
And do you have to peel them at all?
No, we don't peel them. Mm-hmm. We wash them sometimes. They're organic. Little soil's good.
A little grit. For digestion.
And, no, we just rinse them off.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you've got the four kinds of turnips. You've also got lots of other interesting roots, and you've got your Concord grapes over there. Mm-hmm. Tons of stuff.
We have several kinds of radishes, little babies, Shirahimi daikons, our French breakfast radish, a new radish this year, the Bacchus, which is a beautiful purple radish. Mm-hmm. It's gorgeous to look at. You get hungry just looking at it. Mm-hmm. And then our mustards are out. We're all over the place. We have broccoli, apples.
Yeah, I saw the Arkansas black. It sounds like this could be a major place to pick up pesto ingredients from all these greens.
Absolutely. And if you like spice, this is the time of year for it.
You could do like a radish pesto.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah, let's do some.
What time are you having dinner?
We'll do this offline, okay?
Okay.
All right, Dawn, so you're here every Wednesday, every Saturday in Santa Monica.
Yes.
It seems like it's chill. The frost is in the air. It's radish and turnip season and all those nice spicy greens. So Florabella's a place to be.
Thank you.
That was Dawn Birch. She's the farmer. She and her husband, James Birch, at Florabella up in Three Rivers. Like she said, clean water and clean soil. They're right there at the mouth of the Sequoia National Park. It's a beautiful setting, and their vegetables are truly gorgeous. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
In a moment, we revisit my conversation with Nadine Redzepi about her book, Downtime. That's when Good Food continues. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. What do you cook for the best chef in the world? Well, it's a question Nadine Redzepi gets a lot.
So, and I think one of the things that's probably really nice about home cooking for chefs is they get to eat in a way that they don't necessarily do on an everyday basis. So they get surprised in a different way.
Nadine Redzepi, of course, is married to chef Rene Redzepi, whom you heard from at the top of the show. Together, they manage a family of five in Copenhagen, Denmark. Nadine learned to cook pretty early on in life, and now she often finds herself cooking for some of the world's culinary giants who come to visit. This summer, she visited LA, and we caught up with her to talk about her first collection of recipes. It's called Downtime. This interview first aired in August. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up?
I was born in Portugal. My mother is Danish and my father is English. My parents met in Paris, where my father was a street musician and my mother was an au pair. And they lived as street musicians, busking around Europe. After traveling a lot, they wanted to try and settle down a little bit. So my paternal grandfather bought them a small house with a lot of land in a small town in Portugal, which is where I was born. And I would spend all day with my mom. We tried to live off of the land to save as much money as possible. So I spent all day with her, planting things, feeding the animals, walking around in the herb garden, disappearing in the poppy fields. And then my parents split up and my mom had a suitcase and my brother and I, and we went back to Denmark.
So this ability also to be happy with things that are pretty humble, is that why you love the potato so much?
Probably.
Your book is filled with just marvelous potato things.
Potatoes is probably like Scandinavia or even Europe's rice, or, you know, like they have in Asia, or Mexicans have corn. Like the amount of different things and variations that they can make out of one thing, I guess that ours is a potato.
And the picture that I think a lot of people are responding to in your book is of this dish that's baby potato skins stuffed with salmon roe. And I have to say, I just love the picture because the potatoes look like how it would happen to me. Some are standing up, some are laying down. It's not perfect.
Yeah.
It's very real.
Yes. This was something that was very important to me when I was thinking about how I wanted to present the book. Personally, I've never responded super well to these overly styled photos where, you know, you have a plate of something super simple, but then you also have a pair of rusty scissors and like some herbs where the dirt is there next to the plate. It's just so unrealistic. So I wanted everything to look exactly the way it would at home. So just shoot it from the right angle so that you can see what it is, but don't change anything.
Where was Renee working when the two of you first met?
Noma was already open. Noma was about a year old. By accident, I got a shift at Noma. I had a girlfriend who was working at this place outside in front of Noma. And it was a place that was open when the weather was good. You know, never open a place in Scandinavia where you're weather dependent. Does not work here, like in LA, where you guys have rain 10 times a year. Someone was sick in the restaurant and they had called my friend at this restaurant called Noma if she could come and serve water and bread. And she was at another job and she gave them my number. And this Swedish sommelier called me before my friend got to call me, and he was rambling on the phone, like with his accent, I could barely understand him, like, oh, can you come to Noma and work? And I was like, what is happening? Who are you? Why are you calling me? And while he was on the phone, I had this knock on my phone. I guess it was called back then. And I could see my friend was calling me. And I don't know why. I didn't want to, but I agreed to go to this restaurant. And I remember I got super nervous as I got close to the door. And I took a really, really deep breath. And I opened the door to Noma and I walked in, and like, I was completely blown away. I had never seen anything like that restaurant, or like all these new unfamiliar smells, the scents that hit me when I walked in through the door. Yeah, I was completely in love with it immediately.
And soon a different kind of love followed. One of the things I love about the book is that you have a lot of food that can be dipped and eaten with the fingers.
Something crispy and something creamy, I think, is always a really nice combination. But I like to have guests over at our house, and I never prepare anything, maybe a dessert if it's something that I need to bake and then cool down, or something has to set in the fridge. I'll make that before people come. But I like to make everything when people come and we stand in the kitchen and everyone eats around the kitchen while I'm cooking the main course or something. So everyone is around the table for the starter. So it's very practical that it's finger foods.
And another thing that is really apparent is the straightforward way you create things. So the roasted baby back ribs with sweet potato, you don't take out a grill. You don't create a complicated rub. You just make dinner.
Well, I think this is something I probably have from my own mom. I mean, my mom did work quite a bit when I was growing up. But when she was home, she always cooked dinner. And she was the type of person who could cook a meal out of nothing.
When you're entertaining friends who are big chefs from all around the world, and you make those baby back ribs that are basically just with salt and pepper, are they surprised at how much they enjoy it?
Yes, very much. They always ask, what did you do? Did you boil them for a long time? Because I remember I was surprised because I grew up eating ribs that way. That's how my mom made them. And I remember the first time I made them for Renee, he was completely blown away too. Like, what did you do? I was like, I put oil and salt and put them in the oven and cooked them till they looked delicious.
Well, I have to say, I really love the book. It has a wonderful voice and the recipes are very appealing.
Thank you. That makes me very happy.
That was my conversation with Nadine Redzepi from August. We discussed what she cooks in her downtime, also the title of her book. Before we close, I want to talk about the Julia Child Award, which went to some dear friends this week in Washington, D.C. at the Smithsonian Food History Gala. Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger of Border Grill were the recipients. Some of you might know them as the former co-hosts of Good Food. They are the first duo and the first women to receive the award, which was established in 2015. Before the ceremony, I spoke with a member of the selection jury, Dara Goldstein. She's a former longtime editor of Gastronomica and a noted cookbook author.
It's a way of honoring Julia's legacy. I think one of the things that people love about her, and one of the reasons she continues to be such an important figure, is that it wasn't all just about herself. She was a great communicator. She wanted to do things for other people. She wanted to share what she knew. She wanted to give pleasure. And so the award is a way of honoring everything that was sort of personal and public about Julia by giving it to people who don't just do things for themselves, but for the public at large. One of the primary focuses is that whoever is chosen has to be a good educator. And we understand that really broadly. I mean, you could be a teacher, you could be a cookbook writer, you could be an advocate for something, but you have to be able to communicate whatever it is that you're teaching really well.
Who were some past recipients?
The first one was Jacques Pepin, because his cookbooks have been so influential. It's not an absolute criterion, but it's really nice if the person or people, in this case chosen, have had connection with Julia in some way. And it seemed that because they had performed together on TV and really were close colleagues and friends, he was a natural. The second one was Rick Bayless, who changed the landscape for Mexican food and an understanding of what Mexican food is in this country, and also has a really important foundation. And then Danny Meyer was last year. So moving from someone who cooks to someone who has created a deeper understanding of hospitality. And then we really wanted to include women, and Mary Sue and Susan just seemed like the perfect choice in many ways. Besides being public-spirited, and bridge building is another really important aspect of the award. They've done so much for the, not just the community in Los Angeles, but they serve on a lot of foundation boards and do a lot for charity. I think one of the things that really impressed me as well is that they've remained colleagues and friends for so many years. I mean, how often do you have relationships like that that work through so many different iterations of restaurants?
It's almost unheard of.
Yeah. And I think that's something quite notable. Yeah, I'm just so thrilled that the award is being given to them, and I hope everyone will honor them in Los Angeles, too.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Evan.
That's Dara Goldstein. We've been talking about this year's recipients for the Julia Child Award, our friends and former hosts of Good Food, Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger. That is all we have for this week's show. If you missed any of it, you can always listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts, like Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And as always, please tell a friend and leave us a great review if you love the show. Many thanks to the Good Food team. They are Nick Liao, Rosalie Atkinson, Laurel Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.